It's Friday, July 20th. I'm Colm Quinn, and welcome to The Readout. This week began with Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin's meeting in Helsinki, but it was the press conference that followed that made the most headlines, when the US president appeared to reiterate his claims that Russia was innocent of any interference in the 2016 US presidential election.
My people came to me, Dan Coats came to me and some others, they said they think it's Russia. President Putin, he just said it's not Russia. I don't see any reason why it would be.
The resulting media storm led to a swift backtracking by the president.
In a key sentence in my remarks, I said the word would instead of wouldn't. The sentence should have been, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be Russia. Sort of a double negative.
However, the good vibes clearly remain, as yesterday it was announced that Vladimir Putin has been invited to the White House this coming fall, a fact that Trump's Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, seemed a little surprised by when the news was announced on stage at the Aspen Security Forum.
The White House has announced on Twitter that Vladimir Putin is coming to the White House in the fall.
Say that again?
Okay.
That's going to be special.
And so to talk us through the significance of this week for US-Russia relations are Alia Oliker, the director of the Russia and Eurasia program at CSIS, and her deputy, Jeff Mankoff. You may also know them as the hosts of our Russian Roulette podcast. So Trump met Putin in Helsinki, and I think what made all the headlines was this press conference. A lot of people up in arms about it. Gary Kasparov said that, you know, it was the darkest hour of the presidency. Maybe that's a little hyperbole, but you know, you guys follow this, you follow Russian issues and you follow US-Russia relations. So was it as bad as people have described it?
It was pretty bad.
It was pretty weird.
It was, my first response to it was that it was very odd. Look, what I thought was really striking was you had a summit that really produced remarkably little, some at least as initially presented at that press conference, right? I mean, I was sitting there listening to Vladimir Putin, who said, we handed over a paper on arms control, and it was all the usual arms control talking points, New START extension, American missile defenses, INF. We talked about Syria. And I'm sitting here going, okay, wait, where are the takeaways? I'm sitting here poised with my pen. Captains of industry are going to meet. Okay, did anyone tell the captains of industry and how many of them are sanctioned? You know, so he's going down this list. But it sounds to me like very little was accomplished. And I'm wondering, I wonder if it's because the State Department and the NSC, the White House as a whole, were just concerned about having anything that suggested the United States was doing favors to the Russians and had therefore stopped short of any commitments.
Well, I'd say a couple of things. One is that, first of all, we don't actually know what they agreed on because...
Well, I was going to get there.
Okay. But because there was the whole sort of off-the-record meeting between just the two of them, and in the days since the press conference happened, there have been these reports that, well, you know, we agreed to do this, and now it looks like there's going to be an invitation to Putin to come to the United States, so they must have talked about that.
Right, but we're getting ahead of this, right? Because kind of the weirdness of the press conference.
Right,
So you've got this summit, which seems not to have clear outcomes, at least as presented by Vladimir Putin and his talking points. And then Donald Trump in his talking points also does not suggest any real outcomes, but he does go off on a rant, which is fairly typical of his appearances for those who are prone to watching them, but very unusual for those who are prone to just watching press conferences after meetings of heads of state, where he talks about the US election and he talks about Hillary Clinton. And he talks about there not being any collusion, demonstrating that he's far more concerned about the accusations of his team's involvement than with accusations of Russian interference, which is actually potentially a very reasonable position to hold if you're Donald Trump. But that gets so much attention. And it just occurs to me that if the reason that there were no clear outcomes from this summit was because the United States was nervous about appearing to bend over backwards to please the Russians, boy, were Donald Trump's comments at that press conference counterproductive and a little bit ironic. And now that we're hearing about what might have come out of the secret meeting that preceded the meeting with the teams, which apparently were things that were not then discussed by the team, since it seems to be news to them also, which is a little surprising. You wonder if there were, you know, if they did agree, for instance, to extend New START, the arms control treaty that could use, you know, a few more years to give us all time to negotiate something we all like better, should we want to do that. Is that going to be undermined by just the optics and the mess and just how confusing all of this has been?
Well, and I think another strange thing about the summit was, and a reason that there probably, or that there were not any agreements that were announced early on, was because the preparations for this summit didn't coincide with what you would normally expect from a meeting between heads of state like this. You know, normally you've got months and months of staff work that goes into arranging these kind of summits, and most of the agreements that are going to be signed are teed up well in advance by the staff. And you didn't have that happen this time, and I think in part that's a function of the pathology of this particular administration. In part, it has to do with the domestic political environment where there is so much suspicion about the Trump administration's connections to and involvement with Russia, that they didn't want the political baggage of doing that. So you have the two leaders going in to meet, and they don't have the sort of typical set of pre-baked understandings that you would normally have when they go into a meeting like that. So whatever it is that they talked about, whatever it is they agreed to, was very much the product of their own conversations and interactions, much more than it is the product of a kind of reasoned, orderly process to prepare for the meeting over the course of months.
In these heads of state meetings, usually we learn something new, whether it's about what wasn't said, whether it's about what kind of posture maybe one leader wants to put forward or what they want to put on the agenda. It seems like we didn't learn anything much new from this.
We learned that the Russians are happy to have American interrogators, have the FBI go over to Russia to watch them interrogate the Russian intelligence agents who have been indicted, which is trolling, right?
And we also learned that the Russians did, in fact, favor Trump during the election, that they supported him, even if they didn't, or maybe they did.
That they liked the themselves. Idea. Yes. That they liked that. No, Vladimir Putin personally liked the idea of Donald
yes,
Trump.
Yes, so we supported him. We favored
was, that
him.
That was a shock to Brussels. Relatively no one. I think the...
Well, it was a shock that the Russians were so openly
saying
it, willing to admit it.
What, that he preferred Donald Trump to Hillary Clinton? I mean, I think we all knew that.
Yeah, we all knew that, but there are certain things that just according to normal diplomatic niceties, one doesn't say.
Yes, I think
normal diplomatic niceties, I guess, are out the window.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, exactly.
Yes.
Which is, I think, one of the takeaways.
Here's my other takeaway from this summit. Prior to the summit, there was the usual concern about grand bargains being struck and trades being made, and somehow this would all get, you know, they're going to go into a back room and they're going to divvy up the world and then come back, you know, and shake hands and Ukraine will fall apart and whatever else. I will say the summit and the fallout from it has, I think, finally driven a stake through the already very well-staked heart of the idea of a grand bargain between the United States and Russia, because there's no way.
There's no political constituency for it in the United States. And I think part of the rationale for holding the substantive part of this meeting under such close hold has to do with the fact that Trump knows that there's very little constituency in the United States for doing that kind of a deal, and that anything that he agrees to is going to get ripped to shreds in the press and in Congress and everywhere else.
Well, and these deals are not deliverable, right?
Yeah, and that makes them undeliverable.
The things people talk about, the Russians wanting the United States to give them Ukraine, Americans who want Russia to keep Iran out of Syria. Neither of these things can be delivered by either the United States or Russia. So it's an unrealistic hope, but it has kept coming up.
But even things that would conceptually be in the ability of the United States to provide, like, say, sanctions relief, the political environment in the United States makes it very difficult to envision
Donald Trump, no more than Donald Trump can deliver Europe, Donald Trump also cannot deliver the United States Congress.
Yes.
So, I mean, despite Trump and Putin obviously showing this bonhomie, this kind of vibe, I guess.
Throwing soccer balls around.
Yeah, it's very cute. But still, at the
I'd
end of the day...
I'd have the FBI scan that soccer ball, by the way.
I haven't seen the soccer ball since. But still, when it comes down to like actual policy that you might be able to draw from, national security strategy, national defense strategy still has this idea that Russia is the adversary or the competitor, if you want to put it in a nice way. That hasn't changed, right?
Nope.
Not in the minds of the people who wrote the national security strategy.
Can policy still work if the person at the top of that is not kind of bought in?
I mean, that's what we've had for the last year and a half, effectively. Certainly on Russia, but also on a number of other topics where people kind of just keep chugging along until they're told to reverse course.
And some of them can do that and some of them can't. And those ones typically resign.
So what have we missed out on by not really having a very substantive meeting? I mean, arms control is obviously one. Syria, clearly another. Is time kind of ticking out on these things?
So some of these things get worse. The overall tension gets worse because of the fallout of this meeting. The narrative that Donald Trump put forward and Vladimir Putin was extremely happy to help him out with, and which you're seeing and hearing in Russia now, that the criticism of Trump and indeed all this talk of Russian election interference is just sour grapes by the party that lost the election. That's all any of this is. You know, that's the story they'd like to tell, but it's having a harder and harder time flying in the United States, which makes Russia an even more toxic topic. So it makes it harder for not grand bargains, but the little bargains that it would be good to get, even more difficult to attain in the future, right? So say Vladimir Putin does come to Washington this fall. What, are we going to get a repeat of the same thing? I don't see how we move forward. And I'm somebody who thinks that there are areas where we need to be moving forward.
Yeah, I think there are definitely issues where you need substantive engagement between the leadership of the United States and Russia to deal with. Arms control is one of them. Ukraine is another. European security more generally. Syria, you know, you can go down the list. And I think having a meeting like this that degenerated into such a fiasco means that it's actually harder to have those conversations in the future. Now, not all of them are going to get worse right away as a result, but I think it, at the very least, is a missed opportunity to have some substantive progress in resolving any of them.
Let's try and end on a positive, because someone who's had a very positive last few weeks is Vladimir Putin.
He has.
The World
that's
Cup,
true.
He got to give out the medals. He, you know, still riding on a high there. So.
I mean, he might have liked a real agreement to have come out of the summit, but absent that, standing next to Donald Trump and seeming like
he gets to be the adult in the room.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a nice win for him.
And what does that mean then for what happens within Russia, how he's seen in Russia, how this ends up playing? Do we expect any different policy from them?
I think that the Russians are going to continue to push this idea that the reason that Donald Trump isn't being allowed to have a good mm-hmm. relationship with Russia is because of
the deep state
and the Democrats. And I think and that's a continuation of more of the same. And I think that plays reasonably well in Russia. Though some of the Russian press also was having a good time with Trump's performance, and especially the attacks on the Democrats and kind of bringing American domestic politics into this. It's not something that you see a lot of. In terms of Ukraine and Syria, yes, I think more of the same. But again, I think what's important here is the United States is far from the only player. And what we are going to see potentially constraining and affecting Russia's decision calculus is the fact that a lot of America's allies, partners, and others around the world are starting to just figure out what their own path is going to be because they cannot predict U.S. behavior. That's going to be interesting, and that's going to change how the Russians behave.
Yeah, well, and that's going to change how a lot of those U.S. partners behave towards Russia. It's not necessarily going to make them more hostile to Russia. I think in a lot of cases, you're going to see some of these countries trying to figure out how to make their own accommodations with Moscow because of the belief that they can't, in a pinch, rely on the United States. And I would just add that if anything's going to constrain Russian behavior, it's going to be less the fallout of the summit and things like that than it is internal financial, economic, and political developments in Russia itself.
As fun as this was, people can continue the fun by listening to Russian Roulette. Could you talk a bit about that?
Sure. Well, Russian Roulette is the podcast from the Russia and Eurasia program at CSIS. It's not just Russia, and we promise we have never shot anybody on a podcast episode.
Nor have they shot themselves.
With blanks or with live ammunition. No, we talk about all the things. We talk about culture, we talk about literature, and we talk a lot about foreign and security policy. And I think our most recent episode episode, I was out of town, but Jeff talked to Jeff Rathke about the NATO summit. This was prior to this the summit with Vladimir Putin, and then also answered some mail because we asked folks to write in. But, you know, we've done Georgian food and we've done
Russian literature,
Ukrainian revolutions, and education in Kazakhstan. So I'd encourage folks not just to tune in to new episodes, but also go through our backlog. We've got some really neat stuff there,
which is hopefully available on the CSIS website.
Well, I'm a fan. Jeff, Alia, thanks so much for joining me.
Sure, thanks for having us.
And to prove it's not always doom and gloom on the readout, we'll be discussing some good news.
I thank the people of Addis Ababa for this wonderful reception for the Eritrean president.
One of the world's longest-running conflicts seems to be at an end, as the East African nations of Ethiopia and Eritrea agreed to formally end their state of war earlier this month.
Ethiopia and Eritrea have taken a historic decision towards peace and reconciliation. This is a message to all of us.
I'm very happy to be here. These two people are now one people.
To discuss how this remarkable breakthrough came to be is Dan Rundy, the director of the CSIS Project in Prosperity and Development and the host of his own podcast, Building the Future. So we don't usually get to talk about good news,
right?
On this podcast, but we are. Peace has broken out between Ethiopia and Eritrea, one of Africa's longest-standing conflicts. So Dan, could you talk us through? You were literally just in Eritrea about a month ago. Why is it happening now?
So I was in Eritrea a month ago. There has been a frozen conflict between Ethiopia and Eritrea. Eritrea is a country that broke away from Ethiopia and had a history prior to being a part of Ethiopia from the 1950s until the 1990s as an Italian colony for about 80 years, 60 or 80 years, depending on how you slice it. And after 1991, it got independence from Ethiopia. But in 1998, Eritrea and Ethiopia got into a fight for a number of different reasons, but the spark, if you will, was a conflict over a very small town of 1,500 people called Badme. It's a dot on the map. And they fought a massive war. It was in 1998 or 1999. At the time, it was the largest war in the world, with 100,000 people died between Eritrea and Ethiopia. Eritrea is a teeny country of 4 million people. So imagine losing 20 or 25,000 people in a country of 4 million people. It's an enormous amount of people. And they had World War I style trench warfare. And so it makes me go full peacenik to think that so many people died for a one-horse town and a couple of rocks. I mean, it's just terrible. At the end of this war in 1998, there was a truce and an agreement that was brokered by the African Union called the Algiers Peace Accords that in essence said, we're going to get a bunch of map experts to go look at who really controls this one-horse town and a couple of rocks. The Ethiopians, with the support, the implicit or tacit support of global powers, including the United States, refused to implement the Algiers Accord. And so in essence, you have had a frozen conflict for 20 years. Leadership cohort who helped win independence in 1991 for Eritrea, led by President Isaias Afwerki, who's known as President Isaias, along with his cohort of leaders who were both military and now political leaders, have been in power ever since. And in many ways, the second war in 1998 and this frozen conflict that the Eritreans call no war, no peace, has led to all sorts of challenges for the country and has sort of jammed up the rest of the Horn of Africa on a number of different fronts.
And the ending of that means peace.
Yes. So in the last 6 months, there's been an incredible amount of change in the Horn of Africa. There were in Ethiopia for a long period of time. There was President Meles, and he died in 2002. Then somebody else of the same tribe and the same political party in Ethiopia, the Tigray nationality, and the TPLF, which is part of the coalition of parties that lead Ethiopia, took over. That person left about 6 months ago, and a new prime minister who's from a different tribe, the Oromo tribe, took over. Prime Minister Abiy, he fought in the 1998 war in the Ethiopian military. So he's sort of like Nixon going to China and saying, we're Ethiopia, we're a landlocked country. Our only option is we can get our goods and services. We see ourselves as potentially the next Bangladesh. We want to have people put their factories in Ethiopia. Africa is a good news story. There's an emerging middle class in Africa. They've got a growing economy, and he wants to be a part of modernity. So he looks around and says, okay, I got kind of a messy neighborhood. Some of that is because of my frozen conflict with Eritrea. Some of it is that I'm a landlocked country because I lost my two ports of Asaba and Massawa when Eritrea became independent. So I've had to go to the Djibouti port, which isn't as great as the two Eritrean ports. And if I want to be part of the global economic upside conversation, if I make peace with the Eritreans, I can access the two key ports that Eritrea has on the Red Sea, Asaba and Massawa. So part of this is about their own self-interest. And some of this is because he's not Tigray bumps up against Eritrea, and there's some specific, let's call them, you know, more specific kind of parochial conflicts between the Tigrayans and the Eritreans. I think there have been other folks, including behind the scenes, the United States have been encouraging this movement, that to say, we, Ethiopia, will recognize the Algiers Peace Accord's final settlement, and we will withdraw our troops from this one horse town called Badmay, and we will have a final settlement on the map in terms of the dotted line or the frontier line. And as a result of that, we want to have access to those ports. We want to have telecommunications, which currently didn't exist until like 2 weeks ago. And we're going to start having, Addis Ababa is a big hub for East Africa. And to get to Eritrea is a big pain, at least until a week in the last couple of days, has been an enormous pain in the neck to get there. Much easier if you could go fly Ethiopian Airlines to Addis Ababa and then go to, you know, it's a 45-minute or one-hour flight to Asmara, the capital of Eritrea. What happened was he made a big speech. The Ethiopian president gave a speech a couple months ago saying, I want to implement this accord, and some people didn't like it in Ethiopia. He then said the Eritreans sent a group of people led by the foreign ministry and some of President Isaias's top people in the last 4 weeks this has happened. We're here, today's July the 20th, as you know, Colm. And from there, the Prime Minister of Ethiopia flew to Asmara, completely unheard of. So in the last 2 weeks, he flew personally to Asmara to shake hands with President Isaias. Again, completely unheard of, saying, and there's been statements like, the war is over. Then they opened telecommunications. Then Ethiopian Airlines, I think, did their first flight to Asmara sometime in the last 5 days. So this is moving very, very quickly. It means that there are tectonic shift changes in the Horn of Africa that have all sorts of implications.
And there's obviously a lot in this for Eritrea, one of the most repressive regimes in the world under a lot of sanctions. I suppose they'd be expecting those to be lifted now.
That's right. That's exactly right. So it's a very isolated country. Some people have called it the North Korea of Africa. They obviously don't like being called the North Korea of Africa. It's pretty isolated, though. It's hard to get a visa. There's no ATM machines. There's very limited Wi-Fi. Your Earth people cell phone with the SIM chip doesn't work there. I've been to probably 40 countries in my time at CSIS in the last 8 years, and every one of them except this country, I can use my cell phone. You cannot use an Earth person cell phone in Eritrea. And again, it's behind this war thing and this war issue. They spend the most money, I believe, of any African country as a percentage of their budget and as a percentage of their GNP in Africa on security. And I believe they have one of the largest armies in Africa for super teeny countries. It's a hyper-militarized society. Think of it. So that's why the North Korea, Israel maybe comes to mind as well. It's something like that. You know, because they've been fighting guerrilla wars on and off since the 50s or 60s, they know a lot of bad actors or toughs, you know, not so nice. You know, they know folks who aren't members of the Vienna Boys Choir in the Horn of Africa. And so as part of that, one of the things they did was they supported a group that turned into Al-Shabaab, basically. And so the U.S. led a process in the Obama administration to impose U.N. sanctions on Eritrea, which was in essence an arms embargo. And there's like a full-time group of people, I think in Nairobi, whose full-time job it is to babysit, to make sure this thing happens. There's something called the Somalia Eritrea Monitoring Group, SEMG. And for the last 6 years, the Somali Eritrea Monitoring Group has said that Eritrea is al-Shabaab free, you know, like, you know, dolphins safe, they're al-Shabaab safe, that they haven't been playing around, playing footsie with al-Shabaab. The arms embargo or the sanctions, the UN sanctions should likely go away. That does not take away the fact that President Esaias is a dictator, it's an authoritarian regime. There's very limited ability of freedom of expression, very limited ability of freedom of assembly. They have been able to use this frozen conflict to use that as an excuse for all sorts of things. Not, for, you know, they have a constitution they haven't fully implemented, which I believe sort of enshrines a whole bunch of the things that I just listed as things that they should be doing. They should have normal elections at some point. They've hidden behind this conflict. So I think this is the opportunity for also us to have quiet conversations, or the United States in particular, but others, to say, look, this is your opportunity to kind of re-enter the family of nations, if you will.
And you were there in Eritrea studying this phenomenon of forced migration.
Yes.
Eritrea, obviously a huge provider of
migrants. Exporter of people.
Right. And I assume that just because peace is coming, this phenomenon isn't going to let up.
So I think one of the big push factors for folks to leave Eritrea has been this frozen conflict and this crazy national service. If you're in national service, if you're in military service in the Eritrean army, it can be indefinite from the age of 18 to the age of 50. On the books, it's supposed to be 18 months. So if you're there for 6, 7, 8, 10 years in national service, after about year 6, you're like, hey, I've kind of given at the office. Is there something better than just being kind of in this like frozen conflict? Maybe I'll go to Italy. And so what you had is many, many people have left Eritrea because of this frozen conflict and this crazy national mobilization. So tens of thousands of people have left Eritrea because of, for a number of different reasons, including this crazy forced national mobilization. It's one of the poorest countries in the world, and it's fairly repressive, as I've just, very repressive. So I think there's still, people are still going to leave, but I would argue that the flow of folks is going to be reduced. The other thing, though, Colm, about this forced migration issue, one to think about is, if you are a refugee, which is sort of a specific category of people that are enshrined by a number of global conventions, and you say, and you're recognized as a refugee by a country, that means you're eligible for all sorts of human rights protections and certain kinds of let's call them privileges. And it's important to note this, because the United Nations High Commission on Refugees, UNHCR, sometime in 2011 looked at the situation in Eritrea and said, oh, this is pretty repressive. They've got this crazy national service. And they said, okay, well, what we really need to do is, we're going to recognize if you show up in another country, we're going to we recommend that national governments recognize Eritreans as refugees. Now, they did, the UNHCR did not do this for Somalis. They didn't do this for Ethiopians. They didn't do this for Djiboutians, which are the people you'd call from Djibouti, which I learned while I was there. They didn't do this for Sudanese. There's a pull factor of saying, okay, if I'm Djiboutian or I'm Sudanese or I'm Ethiopian, and I show up in Italy and I say I'm Eritrean, they get refugee status. So there's an incentive for people, even in not from Eritrea, to go to Italy and say, hey, give me asylum. I'm Eritrean and I'm escaping national service. With all the challenges that we've just described, it's poor. It's led by a group of folks who feel as if they've been against the world for decades, and so therefore are kind of suspicious, and, you know, leads to kind of bad, let's put it this way, bad choices. And have had this frozen conflict, is they're in an unusually interesting and strategic neighborhood. So putting aside all of the things that, let's all that is granted that I said earlier, all the challenges, all the criticisms. So we have we had a CIA listening post from, I think, the 40s to the 70s in what was then Ethiopia, which is on Eritrean territory now, because it's on the border. It has like 500, maybe it's 1,000 kilometers of coastline on the Red Sea. It's something like 30 miles across from Yemen, 30 miles across or 40 miles across from Saudi Arabia, and it's about, I don't know, 200 or 300 miles from the Suez Canal and whatever the strait is on the other side of the Red Sea into the Indian Ocean. So it's a fairly, it's a crummy neighborhood, but it's a strategic neighborhood. And so they have two big ports. The UAE uses, I think it's the port of of Assab, which is down, there's two of them. I think Massawa's up a little further north. And they've used the, so UAE has been using that to prosecute their war effort in Yemen, whether one likes it or not. That's just a fact. And so I think if things were to go a certain way, and if things were to continue to change, I wouldn't be surprised if there was a conversation down the road where the United States said, Djibouti has relations not only with the French and the United States, but also with China. The Chinese have taken over the port at Djibouti. The United States may or may not feel comfortable with that and may be looking for a plan B port along with an air base, a place you could post something in the Horn of Africa for, we have security and we have economic interest and we're gonna have growing economic interest in the Horn of Africa. You could see down the road some kind of a conversation that led to the United States having a base in Eritrea. That no one came out and publicly said that to me when I met with the senior leadership. But my big takeaway was, if things went the right way, that wouldn't be a bad, that could be an interesting outcome for the United States, and that could be in our interest. Not today on July 20th, but let's see how things progress over the next 24 months.
And that was Dan Rundy, bringing us to the end of this week's show. By sheer coincidence, this week's guests are all hosts of their own podcasts. So if you ever feel like you want to take a deeper dive into specific issues, do check out our wide selection of podcasts on csis.org. As always, if you've anything you'd like to say to me about the show, you can reach me at cquinn@csis.org or on Twitter. We'll of course be back with another episode next week. Until then, this has been The Readout. I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.